To draw is not just a matter of putting your hand out into the world and making a line on a piece of paper. It's also drawing information into your retina, through your eyes, into your brain, and therefore understanding the world, engaging with the world. What I'm trying to do without it being a plan is to find a language and a way of interacting with the world that rings true.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is Julian Opie. Welcome, Julian.
Thank you.
Julian, how did you get to art and the professional?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine now, but when I grew up, being an artist wasn't an option at all. It wasn't even something that existed. I didn't know that there were artists. I knew there was art because I went to museums regularly. We had a Museum of Modern Art that was actually run by Nick Sirota at that time. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that, but we had amazing shows like Solowit, which was really inspiring back in the 70s to see. So I knew that art existed, but I didn't think that anybody actually made it or that you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about it. It just wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
I think now art students are much more knowledgeable about that. They might even go to openings of galleries.
Yeah.
But I didn't go to an opening of a gallery until I'd left art school.
Yeah.
I didn't know that there were galleries in London. The only reason I knew that there were galleries was that my tutor was showing in galleries and he started to introduce me to that world.
Yeah.
So I just made art as a lot of people, almost everybody does, as a natural activity, like part of the role of playing. So you'd play some games, you'd do some drawings, you'd go and play football against a wall. You know, these were things that we did. But I guess everybody began to go their own way. Like some people would play the football more and some people would do the drawing more. And to me, drawing gave me back much more enjoyment and engagement and a sense of Moorishness. If you've got a really good book on the go or you're playing a good computer game, it's actually quite difficult to stop. It's quite drug-like in its draw. You just want to escape back into your book. And for me, doing a drawing and then doing another one that's better than the one before had that quality. I never wanted to stop. Mm-hmm. I had to be dragged away from it. My mother used to draw. She wanted to go to art school, but the war came along and she became a nurse in the army. And then by the time she got out, she kind of gave up on the idea. And my grandfather was against the idea of girls going to art school. So, but she drew as a matter of habit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think seeing her doing that as something that you do for fun was quite influential. She would, every time there was a pause in the day on the holiday, she would sit down and do a watercolor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd find sketchbooks done at the same time where I was probably doing it sort of sitting next to her.
Interesting.
So I think I owe quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Like to a role her, model, but not as a profession, but as a...
As an activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I always would carry a little book around with me. Sometimes I'd make the books myself out of torn sheets of paper so that I could notate what I was seeing around me. And it became a habit to draw the people at the cafe next to me as I became a kind of cigarette-smoking teenager in the local cafes of Oxford where I was at school. I would draw the people at the other tables to capture their faces without a very strong sense of why. It just seemed like a normal thing to do. And then friends started to say, you should go to art school. That always sounded like the thing that people did who didn't have the ability to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the loser track, go to art school because you don't know what else to do. But it began increasingly to occur to me that I would really love that. So my father, who's an academic, I continued to apply for universities to become an academic because that's what you did. But at the same time, I applied for art schools because my mother kind of allowed for that. And I didn't see any dichotomy at the age of 17 between heading in two different directions. I didn't worry about that. I just did. And at a certain key moment, I must have said, okay, I'm going to the art school.
So but they took you also immediately. Because that's often the next step. Huh? One thing is to want to do it.
Yeah, this was back in the late 70s when going to college was a much easier activity. You tended to get paid for by the state.
Okay.
And it was a sort of fairly easy track. Actually, I was supposed to go to art school in Oxford, but I ended up managing to persuade everything and body that I could go to London. London had this draw. I was born in London. I knew London pretty well because my grandparents lived there and I lived there until I was two or so.
Yeah.
So I was familiar with London and it felt like the place to be. Whereas going to art school in Oxford, I felt like I'd had enough of that small town.
Yeah. Okay. But that worked out then.
Yeah, I think it worked out well. I absolutely loved art school. I kind of hated school. I hated, that's too strong a word. I was disinterested and not very good at it. But art school, I immediately just felt completely in my element, and I described Goldsmiths before.
Exactly.
That it was this great freedom of just doing what you want. And I had this great teacher who was called Michael Craig Martin, who's a well-known artist in London with whom I share a lot of... But I still didn't know what being an artist was. No one did back then. But,
yeah, and the market was not so present either, huh?
No, in London it was pretty quiet. You know, people were talking about Paris or New York, really, Cologne. But London, you couldn't do anything particularly there. It was just more for fun.
Yeah.
But Michael Craig Martin started to introduce me to the idea of galleries. And in fact, he introduced me to the Listen Gallery, which was the first gallery I joined.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked for a few works to put on the wall. And then I started showing with them and I never had to get a job.
And this is how it all went. But interesting is that you very early on found at Goldsmiths already your language, yeah?
I think I did in retrospect.
I'm
not so sure at the time that I was aware of what that meant or was. But even looking back now, I feel like I've been circling the same issues with the same tools ever since then. But I have, I have more resources now and I've got some history to play with. And I feel like in the early 90s, I had a big exhibition at the Hayward Gallery, which I got the world's worst reviews and a lot of people hated it. But for me, it was like an amazing watershed.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed me to lay out everything I'd done up till then in one environment. In one draw.
Yeah, right.
And understand who I was and what I could do. And I feel like I've been building on that foundation since 1993.
But I'm very happy about this exhibition because I think also in one draw, it shows your practice in many layers.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I'm very excited to show properly. But I have done some small shows over the decades in Berlin, but I've never really had an opportunity to really lay out a comprehensive experience.
Yeah.
And so this is a really great chance to do that.
No, but I'm also very happy about, it's the first time we do the whole building, designated to one artist. And I think it's very good to do it.
Well, I'm very honored.
Yeah, because it's a full experience and you can really dive deep into and live through one artist's practice on all angle, you know, from the beginning, courtyard, the lookout to the sculpture garden. No, I'm very happy and look forward to see it complete.
Great,
me too. Would you make this difference, sculptor, artist? Would you connect yourself to sort of one medium?
It depends on the context. If the taxi driver asks me what I do, I'm happy to say I'm an artist.
Yeah.
If you're at the border crossing into another country, saying you're an artist begins to sound a little suspicious. So I tend to say sculptor because that's a job. People can imagine you using your hands and constructing something. If school kids ask you what you do, I think saying an artist, maybe it sounds a little pretentious.
Or
same at a party. It sounds like you think that you are at a certain level. But of course, being an artist doesn't mean that. It just means that that's what you spend your day doing. I went to Goldsmiths College in the 70s and 80s, late 70s. And there they didn't have these categories. And that was part of the reason I chose that college. It didn't have a painting department and a sculpture department. Basically, it was an old hospital, one big building. And you would wander around every day, opening doors and seeing what was happening inside this room. And one of them might be where they were grinding up metal bars. Another one, you know, these were all bikers with tattoos and their motorbikes parked outside and they were pouring metal into molds and welding things. I found myself getting quite excited by the welding, the way you could kind of build things up into the air. And then another room would be doing films. I got quite excited with the films. I found myself turning drawings into animations, which was something that was available at that time. There was a life room at the other end of the corridor. I would wander in there and join in the life classes. There would be a naked person standing in the space and you could spend the whole day. I did what the other kids were doing, which was drawing them, but I would move around the room and draw them from one side and another side and another side. They'd often take those drawings to the film department and turn that into an animation, making the naked model kind of turn around or something like that.
Oh, wow. So very early on, like what you have been doing the last decades, you did started then already, yeah?
It seems that nothing really is very new. It's just a matter of constantly revisiting and rediscovering your own interests and refining them, adding to them, learning from previous mistakes. My assistant today, we were hanging a painting in this show here in Berlin, and he said, oh, this looks like a drawing I found of yours from 1979 in the drawers at the studio, because we're moving the studio at the moment, so a lot of these old stuff is coming out. And it's true, there's a drawing in there from 1979 that's basically the same sort of thing, but it's done in charcoal on a piece of paper, and I didn't know what to do with it, and it sat there and just stayed there. So that, for me, that's the way that things work. It's not really a progression. I wouldn't say that what I do now is any better, and I hope not any worse than what I did in 1980s. It's just revisiting, readdressing, learning, reacting. So this show holds some themes that I've really been playing around with forever.
But so you are a sculptor coming from drawing.
I think drawing is a good way of covering all those bases. You can draw with film, you can draw with sculpture, you can draw with painting.
Yeah.
I guess I would probably say I'm not a painter. I do know some painters, and I know that I'm not them.
Yeah.
Because they always have paint on their clothes, they have paint on their hands, they go to the studio every day and stretch canvases and put paint onto those canvases. That's not the way I work. I very rarely use a canvas, and if I did, it would be because I wanted a canvas object, not because that's how painters make paintings. Do you see what I mean? The difference?
It would be
a decision of materials. And I might well use plastic instead of canvas because that would give a different feeling. So for me, a painting is an object. It's a rectangular, thin object. It hangs on the wall, but it's still an object. It's still a sculpture, if you like. So for me, in that Venn diagram of various things, painting lies within sculpture. It's one element of sculpture because it is a sculpture. A Mondrian painting hanging on the wall is a beautiful, thin sculpture with a surface and a structure within.
What I find interesting is that there is an intermediate or like a transition from your drawing. So every work begins with a drawing still?
It's nice that you say that, because quite often, like yesterday with the interviewer, they said, as people often say, oh, so the beginning of the work is a photograph.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I don't like that.
Oh, funny. I would have never thought so.
Ah, well, thank you.
Because I think for me, it's really sort of three-dimensional drawings, or what I'm, because I've been seeing your work all my life. You know, I grew up in an apartment above my uncle's bookstore where you had books on the facade falling down.
Yeah, in Cologne.
In Cologne, and then we were living there until I was like 4 years old or something like this. And then have, of course, memory is still there, you know. And then, so it's probably the first artwork I've seen. And then ever again and again on art fairs and in museums. And I think what I'm so impressed in your work is that you, and this is, I think, what art is about at all. And we sometimes tend to forget, because in this overproduced contemporary art market also we see, is that the power of art is in the simplicity and often in a line. It's only one line. And I think that's so strong about your work, that you can, with this one line you create when you draw a figure, and that figure can be an LED screen, a sculptor, a painting, all the different medias you use, or concrete slab or whatever. With this one line, you transform an energy, an aura, an eros too. You know, there's sometimes a certain sexiness, sometimes a movement. Very hard to describe energy is what makes it art so much, I think. And that's why I'm interested in this approach from the drawing, and how that's why I thought everything begins with a drawing.
Yeah. Well, you're completely right, and thank you. And I like the way that you put it. I think for me, drawing is the basic activity. And when you say the word draw, to draw water is to pull water out of the well. So to draw is not just a matter of putting your hand out into the world and making a line on a piece of paper. It's also drawing information into your retina, through your eyes, into your brain, and therefore understanding the world, engaging with the world. If I look around the room here, I see it as a series of shapes and lines describing those shapes. I remember as a younger person being in a train, you might have had this experience. As you go through the landscape, you imagine your finger or perhaps a pencil going over the shapes of the trees and the buildings and the telegraph wires as you pass through the landscape. It's a way of reaching out of what's inside your consciousness and your sense of self that's inside out into the in the surrounding environment and drawing what it is that you see. And what's fantastic about being an artist is that I am able to do something with that. It's not the end of the line, the end of the line. It's not the end of the story to just do that process of taking in the world and engaging with it, being excited about it. There's also a possibility of actually putting that back out again, of making something from that, from that experience. So from an early point in my work, I've always felt that drawing is my natural way of reaching out into the world and making a mark, making a recording or a reaction to that experience of looking.
It's another thing which comes to my mind, which sort of joined my upbringing or my childhood, was a book, Driving in the Country. I think I told you about this before.
No.
So it's a small children's book, a hardcover from you, and it's a car which starts in the city and goes through countryside.
Yeah, this must have been around 96. I think I was making some exhibitions where I was exploring the idea of what it was to make an exhibition. Because as an artist, you tend to make one work after the other. Actually, these days, I tend to make various works all at the same time because I have some assistants to help me do it. But let's say you make one work after the other, and when you're asked to make an exhibition, what do? You gather some of these works together and you put them in one place, which creates a new kind of reality. It's not just one work that you're dealing with. It's an environment that's got the works in it, which is something slightly different. And you can choose to ignore that, as many people do. They just see an exhibition as being a series of works and you engage with each one after the other sequentially. But what I wanted to do was to try to make environments with the works that I'd already made. I didn't want to just make an environment and that was the work. I wanted to do this process of making a series of works. So I came up with a system for that. And that system was to make a kind of world for the exhibition. This was a museum in the town of Tours in France, quite a big space with a glass skylight, a little bit like a landscape when you're inside, the sun's moving around. And so I imagined that the floor of the gallery was like the floor of central France. And I placed my works around that space as if it was a landscape that you could move around within. Mm-hmm. So you could deal with each element of my work, the house, a car, a tree, a person, as you passed it. But you could also deal with it as a landscape that you were cycling or walking or imagining your movement through it. And therefore, when they asked me to make a catalogue, I tried to think of a way of reflecting that process. And it struck me that children's wordless books was a, as you turn the cardboard page and it flops open, that was a kind of catalogue equivalent of the exhibition that you would wander through. So I took the car as being the leitmotif of that journey. Mm-hmm. It could have been a bicycle or a train, but a car seemed to work. I was living in France at that time and had a car. And there aren't so many trains. So I used the car as the character that moved through the storybook, and each page revealed a different part of that journey, so, which might be in a town, through the countryside, past a village, that kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Another thing which just came to my thoughts is your work also somehow escapism, because it's a simplification of our world in a way?
Simplification is an interesting word because I get that quite a lot. You know, why and how do you simplify the world? And then my response tends to be, you know, whenever anybody defines you, you always want to fight back and say, no, I'm not like that, but I probably am. And I think I do probably see things in some kind of mental interior world in a simpler way than a photograph would see it. But then at what point do we think of the world as being the real one? Like if you look microscopically, everything we see in front of us is like a forest of atoms and and activity, even a piece of glass, if you get close up enough, it's full of scratches and activity. So at what point do we say something has become simple and something is complicated? It's all a question of like a lens. You can pull that lens forward and see something insanely complicated on your fingertip. Or you can pull that lens right back and see the whole globe or a map or...
Yeah, maybe not so much. Not so much simplified. Maybe more softened or more like a filter.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah,
and I like the word escapism. It's another one that has a slight ring of negativity about it. Like an escapist is someone who refuses to face reality or who is hiding from the real aspects of the world in a safe environment. But hey, don't we all want to do that?
Absolutely. And I think that's a big problem of contemporary art today.
I think escapism is an interesting position. And I recently started using VR and VR goggles, virtual reality goggles, made by Meta. There are other companies that make them too. And I use them to organize exhibitions. So I use them to organize this exhibition. What I can do is I can build a quick model of the gallery space, and then I can build quick models of my works. And then I can walk into the gallery and physically lift and place on the walls or move around on the floor my works to get just the right exhibition. When I was young, we used to have to make cardboard models and crouch on the ground and try to imagine walking into the space with one eye shut, with your head crocked over to try and see what the exhibition might look like. It was very unsatisfactory. Mm. But now I can actually walk at my body size into a room, see the works around. And that was very interesting and very useful. But what I began to find was I wanted my assistant to hurry up and build the new space so I could get in there, because I loved being in there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in there, I would organize the exhibition, but then I would hang around in there for a while. And sometimes I would imagine, I would sort of think, I'll just go back there for a little bit, because there's something about this escapist world of being in the VR environment. I could be in Korea,
mm-hmm.
and the sun is shining, and I can go out into the sculpture garden outside the gallery that I show with, and then back into the space. And there's a quiet in that space. There's a strange calmness about an environment where nothing is actually complicated or however close you go to it, the surface remains the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like to be in a drawing. And what I felt was, this is like my childhood dream of walking into a Giotto painting. I grew up in Oxford, and there are a lot of museums and paintings there. I used to wander around with Sony Walkman on and look at these paintings from the early Renaissance and imagine walking into them, walking from one hilltop town to another with John the Baptist by my side. And sounds a bit weird perhaps, but to walk through these spaces and to walk into the paintings. And here I was with the VR goggles on, actually being able to walk into the space that I created. So I set about dropping the idea of only using this to make exhibitions. And I started to make exhibitions themselves that are only visible through these goggles. So I've made two exhibitions like that, VR exhibitions, where you put the goggles on, you go into the gallery, the virtual gallery, and you see virtual artworks, which is quite escapist in a sense. But it also taught me something. It's given me quite an interesting reviewing of my own works. Because it's quite easy as an artist to forget, like, what are you actually doing? Like, why am I actually going to a studio and buying these materials and constructing these things? Sometimes the purpose and meaning is in focus, and I get it. And other times it's a little distant. But seeing it as through this virtual idea, I got a much clearer idea of what I'm doing with these works, like mm-hmm. the towers in my exhibition here in Berlin. I've built these five 8 meter high towers. And this project of building these has come very much out of doing the same thing in the virtual reality space, where scale is no problem. You're not buying more metal if you make them bigger. You're just pressing a button, they get mm-hmm. bigger. Another button, they turn black or white. What I'm doing in that virtual reality is creating a kind of meaning and a world to look at for the visitor into that space. And I said, hey, that's what I'm doing in exhibitions.
So, but did you started to build these sort of build a space in this 3D model, which then turned out to be a sculpture?
It started the other way. It started by wanting to make a VR exhibition and bringing some models of already existing artworks into that space. But of course, you don't have to worry about gravity. You don't have to worry about scale or weight
or financing.
In virtual reality or financing.
Yeah.
But what's tended to happen is that I've now taken that logic and reality back into my own art, into my own artworks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's encouraged me to make things where the real experience in the gallery at St. Agnes, for instance, is in a way a copy of or an equivalent to the virtual one that I made in the VR space.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like taking the escapism of the computer game, and I used to play early computer Tomb Raider games, almost obsessively during a period of my life where perhaps I was escaping a little bit from the slightly sort of messy surrounding of my life into these. But I was also completely taken with the idea that you could escape into a game, into a story. This was new back then. You know, back in the 90s, the idea that you could actually enter a book was something entirely new. Now, of course, we're all very used to it, although there were films. So that was a certain kind of entering a story. But I think you weren't interactive in a film, but with Lara Croft in Tomb Raider, you're actually entering these spaces. And I wasn't interested in, you know, capturing the enemy or finding the treasure. I was just interested in moving through these drawn spaces. So I've learned over a period to take that sort of what you might call escapism out into the world and to use it and make a space that I'm inviting perhaps other people to escape into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but interesting is that even though with the advanced technology, because that was a big milestone, Lara Croft, so much has happened, but you, I mean, that's again, the drawing, the line, which is not simple at all. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's what makes it art, that the simple line is not that simple. But even though there are more advanced possibilities, it remains very positive world too, and which I see often with collectors, or also whenever I meet your artworks, it's a bit like companions, like positive companions. And it also again reminds me, you know, of like a fake friend you have. And I drew on the wall and had like this sort of duo conversation with an imaginary companion where everything is only positive, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that I find maybe like you are an impressionist somehow.
Impressionist.
Yeah. Because there's no war, there's no crisis, there's no political drama in your practice.
I like the idea of a companion. I don't think I've ever sort of seen it that way, although I do surround myself with these artworks in my studio. I actually tend to, outside of my studio and where I live, I tend to surround myself with other people's artworks. And I think I can understand what your collectors mean by that sense of a companion, that I have a Yepi Hein in my garden and I have some ancient Egyptian artworks in other spaces. And as you get to know them and live with them, they do feel like I wouldn't say a friend, that would begin to feel a bit sad, they feel like a close, there's a relationship there.
A very reliable. You know, very reliable, and you know they're there, and they, you know what to expect from them. Because another moment, which I look back now, which I saw, were one of these dancing girls you did, and then you look at the hip and the movement, and then you look up and you say, it's a circle. The head is a circle. Or also when I look at the portraits, we also have to get to your exhibition and get talk a bit more in detail about what's on show here. But when I look at these portraits you did, there's an emotional connection, which, and then you wonder, how is that possible? Because it's only a couple of lines on the canvas. So, and that's what I think is what makes it so special.
Well, thank you. I think I've always treated art as quite a close activity, in the sense that it doesn't extend very much beyond my brain, eyes, and hand, out to materials, out to references and processes in the world, bringing those into that environment and space. But when I look at other art and when I make art myself, I see that as quite a close reality. Talking about, as you say, war or world situations, for me, the only way I could really talk about those would be to talk about what it's like to hear something on the radio, because I've had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
What I haven't had is the experience of going to war.
Oh, you mean the direct, your own experience? Okay.
Yeah. So for me, for me, the activity of making art is or doing anything really is something that I can only really hold in that sphere that I carry with me, of walking down the street in Islington in London. You know, that's a reality that I know about and can talk about.
Mm-hmm. But so again, the filter, right? There's a filter. Even what you hear in the radio about the war is a filter, like.
That's a filter, so I can talk about the radio and I can talk about the emotion of hearing stuff on the radio, perhaps. I don't quite know how, but but what I can't talk about is some kind of opinion or theory around or over that. If simply describing a leaf that's in your hand can become somehow universal, I think it can. I don't think that you need to talk about something beyond that, really, in order to talk about what it's like to be alive, what it's like to register your own existence, to sense the space that you're in, and to act within that. That, for me, that's the zone of thinking.
So when visitors arrive here at the gallery, they are sort of welcomed by two large figures. I would interpret it, one person arrives and the other one is leaving. Is that right?
These works can actually go in either direction. If you were to come and buy one of these, which we'd encourage you to do, you are free to put them going to the left or going to the right. That's the same with the films, the animation films that I'm showing here. If you have them in a space, you can flick a switch and have them walking to the left or walking to the right. Part of the reason for this is that if you hang it on a wall that's very close to a corner, if you have a painting of someone walking and it's going into a wall, it makes you feel bad. It makes you feel like you're going to get your face hit by that wall. It's much more feng shui, shall we say, to be walking into the space than to be walking into a wall.
Okay.
So since the technology is there, either to turn the sculpture around or to flip the switch and turn the film pointing the other way, why not use it? But when I was planning here with some trucks and some installers and yourself, where to put these works, it struck me that the first figure who's closest to the entrance to the gallery should be walking in. That gives a kind of sense of entrance and invitation to come in. But the figure further away from it, it makes sense that they've kind of feel that they've finished the experience and they're walking out. But more importantly, perhaps, is that the two different directions give you a sense of dynamic motion. The statues don't move. They're actually made of aluminium with car paint on. They can't actually move. In my VR exhibition, they do move. Please come and see it sometime. But in this case, they have to stand still, but they suggest movement. Much as Egyptian carved statues that stride have this, or Assyrian statues or Greek, they have this, often the legs are split in an action of movement.
Yeah, suggested movement.
Mm-hmm. And this gives a dynamic to the work, and it takes you backwards and forwards in time as well. It's not just a matter of the fact that they can move. Movement suggests time. So you can engage with the artwork, not just like absolutely statically now, but also in the sense of where it's come from and where it's going. And also these two works are out on the street, right? What's the name of the street? Friedrich?
Alexandrinstrasse.
Alexandrinstrasse is full of people, a lot of children with schools, walking up and down that street, and they make this kind of dynamic, endless dance of striding people crisscrossing each other. And so I've tried to echo that in a logical kind of way with these two works.
Yeah, it's also interesting, the sculpture to the back. It's not necessarily really leaving, but it's sort of passing by in the horizon somehow. You know, the area here, we are at the geographical middle point of Berlin. It's really the middle point here, opposite the back sculpture, right on the other side of the street. There's a element on the ground which indicates the center of Berlin, which is sort of funny because that's both West and East Berlin.
Yeah.
And the neighborhood here was completely bombed. The church was rebuilt with the gravel from the houses which used to stand here. So it's like a circular recycled building.
Yeah.
And where the sculpture comes from, or where it looks like coming from, is walking out of this settler new build area. Anyway, so what I find interesting is that I told you the, what's the name, you know, like a play figure, like a playmate you use for a cardboard, but that's not that my association was, but that's not what, like, how did you get to that shape and to the concrete slab, which is a I think it's more than just a pedestal. It's part of the sculpture too. How did you get to that shape and the materialization? And did I understand right? They're identical from both sides, right?
It's identical from both sides. Yeah. That's right. So it's as if a drawing had been extruded. I don't know if you have a German word for the extrusion, where you take something that is flat and by pulling it into three dimensions, it becomes like extruded aluminium is something you often see, where the shape of the aluminium is through a machine is extruded out into a long tube kind of space. So I often use extrusion as a way of turning a flat paper drawing, if you imagine that. And then if you extrude that into a tube shaped but around the drawing that you've made, it can stand up. So it's like turning a thought or an imagined drawing into an object simply by making it three-dimensional, by pulling it into a thickness. So if you imagine you draw, let's do a leaf again, but you draw it on a piece of wood, and you cut around that wood, but it's a very thick piece of wood. Suddenly you have a three-dimensional sculpture of a drawing of a leaf. So by using this extrusion, I remain in the world of imagined, when I say imagined, I mean a thought in your head, an image in your head, that a line drawn with your finger around a shape, or let's say a shadow perhaps of a person, a flattened version, that you then extrude that out. It can become a statue or a drawing. And it's something that I play with a lot as one of the processes that's available. It's not the only process that's available to turn a drawing into a statue. You can also put the drawing in between two sheets of thick glass and stand that glass on a base, and then the drawing can float in space as a three-dimensional thing, but it's actually kind of flat. There are other ideas too.
And tell me the silhouettes on the sculptures, so that what makes it sort of double three-dimensional in the vision. I mean, the sculptures are three-dimensional as you just described in the extension, but also sort of the silhouette or the shadow is painted on the aluminium surface.
Yeah, there's a kind of doubling up there, both of a drawn three-dimensionality. One leg is in front of the other, obviously, because we're built that way. But there's also a physical three-dimensionality, which is somewhat at odds with the drawn one. So the three-dimensional extrusion is taking a flat drawing and pulling it out until it stands up. But the drawn three-dimensionality is a created one that is done through imagery.
Exactly. And this creation, is that freestyle or do you follow a process?
I've tried to, I can draw. Sometimes my kids say, why don't you just draw? And I do sometimes in the mornings when I get up early and I go to work and I want to send a message to one of the family members. I don't tend to write it. I tend to draw it. So we have lots of pieces of paper lying around at home on the table with these drawings about, you know, feed the cats or I'll be late or something. But I only tend to use drawing as a language these days. When I was younger, I used it as a form of notation. To be honest, now I use my iPhone because it's very high resolution and it doesn't do any editing. So I can take all of the information without making any decisions about the editing at that stage. So for me, drawing is a kind of a process that's part of the building of the artwork. It's not really any more a freehand habit that you might imagine. Sorry, your question again was?
No, I wonder how you, also when the visitor continues, you see a freestanding concrete, two-dimensional, three-dimensional object of a Asian woman's portrait. How do you, I'm curious to understand, how do you do the sort of filtering or the
so yes, I remember now where
the
I was
transformation
going.
Of the drawing.
So what I did at a certain point in the late 90s was I started to look around for a way to draw humans. I don't really want to just, I mean, I do just draw them, but what does that mean to just draw someone? You know, what references are you using? What style are you using? Where does that come from and how does that count? So I wanted to find a style that existed in the world, and I tend to do that with everything. I'll find a system of drawing in plastic signs on the high street or in airport LED display systems. I don't invent them myself. I gather them like an explorer might, and I can only use what I can find. So all the stuff you see in this exhibition is stuff that I've found. It's almost like a collage of found effects. And that's true of the drawing as well. Mm-hmm. And the initial drawings of humans were found looking at signs and symbols, particularly around my studio, which used to make, they used to make furniture in that area of London. And there's a lot of shops selling furniture elements, including signs for doors, like let's say the male and female lavatory. Mm-hmm. There would be a sign with a drawing of a man and a drawing of a woman. And I looked at those, I bought some. And I thought, here is a symbol that is also a drawing. Like these are definitely people. I mean, an alien would recognize that these were drawings of humans, mm-hmm. but they're very universal and symbolic and symmetrical. So what I did was I took a photograph of my neighbor who runs the shop next door to the studio, and I put his photograph on top of this male lavatory symbol.
And was it a full body symbol? Full body. Yeah.
Standing, mm-hmm. facing you in the way that the male lavatory door person does. It's not walking past, it's facing you.
Yeah.
And I put those two things together and I bent the lavatory man to fit the photograph of my neighbor. And then it made me laugh because it looked like my neighbor, but it also looked like the lavatory man.
Mm-hmm.
And so I set about drawing everybody I knew. Like I gathered my family, friends, people on the street, and started to see if I could draw them all with that same heavy, thick line.
But you said you did a photo and then transformed the photo into a drawing.
No, I did. I mixed the lavatory symbol, which mm-hmm. I scanned.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have photocopiers. Do you remember photocopiers?
Yeah, yeah. Xerox.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I took a photocopy of the lavatory sign and the photograph printed mm-hmm. of the person and kind of merged them together on the computer.
Yeah.
To allow me to use the system of symbolic drawing. So then you start to think, okay, so where does the symbol for male and female lavatories come from? This comes from an ancient and human activity of making symbols for the world, which we use to communicate. So if you don't know the language, you can always draw. There was a recent film, and it's got great music by Max Richter, who I work with, and we get onto that. But it suggested that it was very difficult to talk to aliens. And they had this language professor come in and try to find a way to communicate with words with these aliens. I think he would just draw.
Mm-hmm,
like you don't need to worry about language. You know, if you go to a foreign country now, of course you use your phone. But when we were younger, we used to actually draw maps
absolutely.
Or signs.
Yeah.
And this is drawing not as an expression or a discussion about politics or the world or anything. It's drawing as communication and hieroglyphs and lavatory doors.
Absolutely,
And road signs all give me this language of drawing. And so if you look at all the drawings in this exhibition here in Berlin, they're all drawn with a very thick, regular line, which is in a way the line of language, of communication, like a typeface, as if I've invented a typeface for the whole world.
But what I understand now, which I find very interesting, so I think that the, where I don't have a better word than simplification, or reduction, probably it comes from the washing out from the Xerox. You know that it's not, because that's not a photo, it's a sort of physical reproduction, but then the, you know, it's not so precise. It's, mm-hmm. It has a different grain, mm-hmm. right? And then all the shrinkles in the face and all these sort of, they become more simplified. Is this how the evolvement of the...
I think so. I think people tend to think that bottom line reality is like a photograph. If you want to turn reality into art and put it on the wall, bottom line, you start with a photograph. But I would disagree with that.
Yeah.
I don't think a photograph is very similar to reality at all. It's a piece of magic. It's a 19th century invention that was along with a lot of other pieces of 19th century illusionistic language and magic, like lenticular screens that gave three-dimensional depth or movement, or the early cinema, or shadow plays, silhouettes. All of these are optical games that give an impression of reality, but I wouldn't say that they actually were reality. And or that there are some kind of base of reality. So I don't think that we start with a photograph and then move into simplification from there. I think that the way that we understand, view, and deal with the world is a complex and maybe probably different for everyone. I only know my own way of doing it. But if I think about Danai, who's sitting next to me here, I'm not actually looking at her because I'm looking at you, Johan. But I've got a good sense of the shape and the hair color of and the dress of Danai here, but it wouldn't be a photo. If I wanted to represent that, a photograph would come nowhere near it. And
yeah.
You know, one begins to think about
maybe a drawing more
cubist ideas of like sort of jagged shapes that aren't in order, that represent closer to how we actually see the world close up. For instance, you know, if you're kissing someone, you don't see their face as a photograph. You see an eye here and a chin there. So I think what I'm trying to do, without it being a plan, but looking back, I think that what I'm trying to do is to find a language and a way of interacting with the world that rings true. And it's not that I never make photographs as art. I recently just started a whole new project of photographs of landscapes, but that would just be one tool in the toolbox of many as to how to recreate, how to represent what it feels like to look at the world, to engage with the world, to draw the world.
Yeah, I think the problem of photography, but that's a whole another conversation, it's a problem of aging. You know, you can tell the period of time from a photograph.
Yes, and within a photograph, 10 seconds later, it's history.
Yeah.
And it moves away from you in that way, and it rigidly grips the moment in which it was taken. There are ways of adjusting that to a degree, but generally it has this quality. It's the same with a sound recording. I often use sound in the artworks that I make, but a sound recording of a voice is very difficult for it not to feel like a recording of a past moment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't stay present. Music is very different. Every time you play Bach, it's present. It's here. It's with us. It doesn't particularly feel like it was done in the 17th century.
And looking at this concrete sculpture, the concrete portrait, which I find interesting, is because there, again, you have one material. So it's like, it's brutalist, very honest material. It has no lacquer, no surface on it. And interesting also is you create a drawing or a shape, a silhouette, an image from one material. So you don't have something applied on it, right? I guess that's what carried you to that, using this, no?
Yeah, so just to explain, in the exhibition, we got works in the main space, and we got works in the lower floor, which is smaller scale, and then a number of works placed around the gallery. There's also a work that's been sent out to as many people as we could as an invitation card, which I would conceive of as much a little artwork, an artwork within the conversation of the whole exhibition. So I've tried to use every space and opportunity that the gallery has offered me. And in the courtyard, before we go into the actual museum gallery space itself, there is a large scale concrete sculpture, which is relatively new for me. And as I've been making works which are generally drawn and painted, I've always had as an ambition to see if I could minimize that down to simply one material, not placing layers or colors or one image onto another substructure, but actually making the substructure the image itself. And I think that I learned the answer to this challenge by looking at ancient art. And I think every artist's relationship with other art is probably a little different, but my relationship to it has always been twofold. On the one hand, I admire it and learn from it and seek answers to my own questions. And on the other hand, I see in it something that I've already done myself. So if I'm working, let's say, on flat drawings of people, I then might come across an artist like Auguste Edouard, who's the hero of 19th century silhouette art. And I see in the work that he did a kind of a bounced reflection of what I'm interested in. Obviously, you know, he's a great artist and I'm not comparing myself to him. I'm just saying that I sort of see in it something, my own interests.
Yeah.
So that draws me to that work. And then I start to look at other silhouette artists, and then I start to look at Kara Walker, who's also interested in Auguste Edouard and does a fantastic silhouette art, and I buy both.
Yeah.
Because I'm a very acquisitive person, and when I see something I like, I want to have it. So I have examples of both of these and more. But so that's one way of dealing with it. The other way is to learn from looking at that art, which is more acceptable if you're dealing with ancient art than it is if you're dealing with your contemporaries. Borrowing from your contemporaries is a little more complex operation, but I think it's feasible. You know, I don't mind if people borrow from me, and I'm flattered, and I I can't help but borrow from things that I admire by other contemporary artists. But in this case, I would say that the incised line into a material is largely borrowed from looking at Egyptian carved stone walls. But bear in mind and remember that those carved stone walls would have been painted. What we now see as beautiful raw sandstone or greywacke granite carved into, in most cases, would have been painted as well. But they're not anymore because they're thousands of years old.
Yeah.
The paint's gone.
Wash off, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I saw a way of moving forwards into concrete that was based both on these ancient relief drawings, but also based on the kind of concrete blocks that are placed to stop tanks or rogue lorries mm-hmm. going down a street. And so you asked me before about war and mm-hmm. That kind of reference.
Mm-hmm.
My experience, I suppose, would be that I know the feeling of those concrete barriers, and I know the received information as to what those concrete barriers do, that they are there to stop a truck driving mm-hmm, down that street mm-hmm. or even in between in a motorway to stop one car leaving the motorway, crashing into the cars coming on the other way. So they have quite a disastrous and upsetting presence in a way, but they also have quite a stoic beauty, like a castle. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in castles. You know, these are a very human basic activity to protect yourself by gathering the rocks in the valley below you and piling them up to protect yourself against mm-hmm. Invasion. And I often visit castles and see them as an extraordinarily human sculpted environments in a way. And I've made sculptures of castles on various different scales. And I would suppose this statue of a person that I was working with in Korea a few years ago took a photograph of her face, made a drawing of it, and then turned it into a concrete barrier, if you like.
Oh, really? You had that in mind, yeah? A concrete barrier?
Well, mm-hmm. yes,
okay.
I did.
Interesting.
I mean, in the sense of, like, if I want to make something, yeah. I gather it from the environment, from the world around me. So
yeah.
if I pass a good concrete barrier, I'll take a photograph of it.
It's pretty rare, huh?
Well, not if you're driving down a motorway. They're all the way down for miles and miles. Or often if you go to contemporary beaches in ports,
yeah.
you know, instead of piling up boulders to stop the sea, they make these hexagonal shaped stars of concrete,
mm-hmm.
you know, these things, and they pile
yeah.
them up
yeah.
so that they lock into each other. So it's like a human version of a boulder.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And
yeah.
these are beautiful objects.
Yeah.
They're extraordinarily sculptural, but they're not there in order to be a beautiful abstract sculpture. They're there to stop the sea and to lock into each other.
Yes, I thought more of the city landscape, you know, because there's interesting, there's here from the Axel Springer building next door, they're like little concrete mushrooms. So they try to be a bit more positive, you uh-huh. know, and then there's another one. It's not actually a concrete barrier, but it's a graffiti to avoid that the fence gets graffiti. So Herzog de Moron designed the fence, which looks already like a graffiti.
Okay.
So because like, but here it's interesting because I didn't think of it. It has really so it has this disastrous.
Well, I don't know about.
Fear element in
I
mind,
think
yeah?
A large concrete barrier has a certain physical effect on you. I'm not really asking people to translate that into a historical moment or a particular political situation, but rather that a large, heavy, two-ton concrete block with a base mm-hmm. that's integral and is dropped by a crane makes your body feel a certain way. And that's a useful part of a drawing. A piece of paper makes your body feel very differently.
Mm-hmm.
A large piece of paper hanging onto wires would have a very different feel as it blows in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this heavy piece of concrete is something that I can then play off against this quite sweet drawing of an individual wearing glasses with a hairstyle that is particular.
Mm-hmm.
So one's relationship to someone with a particular hairstyle and wearing glasses looking at you has a certain kind of mood, let's say.
So sure, this positive companion. Huh?
Yeah, so if you imagine a piece of music,
yeah.
this might be like a sweet violin or sweet voice
yeah.
in the tune. But then you imagine that the presence of a heavy concrete barrier has its integral one-ton base to stop it being pushed over. That's like the drums.
Probably it's rhythm. my very strong and intimate and common relationship with concrete. I thought, I was more thinking of that you are able to create a drawing and sculpture with one material only.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like Brutalist Kitchen too. You know, you have two ingredients and create an amazing taste experience with only radish and, I don't know.
I think that's a perfect description of what I was trying to do, trying to make a successful meal out of a number of ingredients.
Yeah.
One of those ingredients is this drawing of G1, who's a gallery assistant in Korea.
Yeah.
And the other ingredient is raw poured concrete.
Concrete, yeah.
And in this case...
Brutiful.
Yeah.
And it's the first time you show this?
Actually, this is not a brand new work. No, okay. There are some works in here that we unwrapped.
Because it looks so mint.
For the first time, others that have been around. This work's never been outdoors before.
Oh, that's why. Okay, yeah.
It was indoors in Mallorca, in Palma, in an exhibition I think you saw.
I saw it, yeah. Interesting how the reception is different.
Feels very different indoors.
Once it's outdoors, yeah, interesting.
I'm actually very happy with it outdoors.
Yeah, very
it's
beautiful.
It's catching sunlight here in a very nice way.
Yeah.
That's casting heavy shadows and really bringing the life of the work out.
Absolutely. And also in this concrete environment, which I find so interesting. I thought it was very much informed by your working and growing up in the UK, where like Smithsons and Brutalism is sort of coming from. And
well, I lived for quite a while in something called the Barbican Centre in London,
exactly.
Which is a similar discussion of
post-war.
That's
Smithsons too, yeah.
Brutalist architecture. And yes, I have, in fact, four of those sculptures installed just around the corner from the Barbican at the moment. That's up for a year or two. And any modern town that we know of, the center tends to be a kind of concrete environment that is a sort of fitting setting. But this right next to the wonderful St. Agnes Church, which is a great brutalist work, I find myself taking photographs which always try to kind of include the tower or a couple of the walls of the surrounding church, because they seem to play off the sculpture very nicely.
Yeah. Okay, so let's continue. We passed the two sculptures. We passed the portrait by Min Jun, right?
At G1.
And that's the title of the work also?
Yes, I tend to use, if I'm drawing a person, I tend to use their name.
Yeah.
Seems fair.
Then we come in and there's sort of an Ahn gallery, you know, like an ancestor gallery, a little bit, maybe?
That's a nice thought. I hadn't really thought about that way, but yes, I see that. We've got a smaller space before going up to the nave, which is the main space. And I thought that I would have a discussion exhibition there that continued G1 in concrete outside into the gallery using more domestic materials.
Than
the concrete. We've got granite, wood, plastics, and some mixed media.
Yeah, interesting. So you sort of declinate or, you know, like the different, play with the different materialities.
Well, there's always a choice for an artist as to how to present a group of work. You know, you can have all of the works from a series. That has a very strong, powerful effect. Or you can have one from each of the various series that you're working on at the time. I've chosen two from each.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that by doing this, it would highlight the difference and the use of materials. If I only showed wooden pictures of wooden portraits.
It's good. Is it a sculpture? Is it a painting? Is it a picture? Because I mean, that's what they are. They are like hybrid. After all, as you described at the beginning, they're sculptures, but they are pictures, drawings, paintings, all at once, right?
Yeah, all of those things. If I was to do all of them in wood, I think that the wood itself would become a sense of like that being a natural way of doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's not. It's a choice amongst many. So by putting in these different materials, I think that's going to highlight what it feels like to do this process using granite, what kind of references that draws out. If you use black granite, it has quite a somber... funereal quality to it. If you use oak that's got a grain in it, it has quite a natural, soft, nature interfering type of mood to it. You can see the grain of the wood. If you use brightly colored acrylic sheet, it has quite a commercial city center advertising kind of quality to it. Mm. Each of these qualities has a very strong effect on the work, and they're things that I play with. That's how I go about making a work. Doing the cooking that you describe is bringing in these different kinds of elements. What happens if I use the slick, slightly off-putting but very desirable gloss of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
If I bring that into the picture, you know, what effect will that have?
So yeah,
I'm kind of playing around and experimenting. When I see something that works well, I go for it.
Yeah.
I don't think, oh, but that's not what I meant.
Yeah,
that's
not
what I wanted
to
say.
You just do it and see
it
done.
I just do it.
Yeah,
and if
realize it.
And then take what works well from that and then think, oh, I can make that bigger or more.
So, and then we leave upstairs, continue.
Just to fit into, if you wanted to describe the show, so we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I think we've got 11 of these small portraits of people from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are children. Some of them are Olympic British sprinters
mm-hmm.
that were from the team racing recently in Paris by chance from another project. And some of them are just general people that I pick up from my travels around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yes, we move on upstairs.
And all of these, some you have relationships with too, with others not working random.
In the case of portraits, I've always got the name because I need the person to stand in front of me. And I can't do that process out on the street with strangers.
Yeah.
I also think that there's a point at which I would begin to feel a little uncomfortable about the intrusion of a Zoom lens focusing right in on people's faces.
Yeah.
But I also need a very neutral face. I have to tell people immediately, please don't smile.
Yeah.
Please hold your head absolutely level and directly at me. These things require a relationship between me and the person.
Yeah.
And that creates a relationship between the viewer and the picture. So when you look at these pictures, they're staring straight back at you. None of these have got their head turned away from you. None of them are looking at someone else. They're all looking directly back at you like a mirror.
Yeah.
And that has a very particular...
Very interesting. You project your own mood somehow on them, huh?
Well, that too. But I think also you feel confronted by them, which is a very particular human experience to be mm-hmm. confronted by another face. That's a complex relationship. You know, mm-hmm. there's attraction, there's fear, there's awkwardness. All of those things have a certain kind of power that is something that you can play with.
And then you leave that Arne Gallery upstairs. And what I find interesting, which I'm very happy about, how the architect actually designed the building, you pass by the arriving sculpture we met at the first site when we arrived on the grounds, because you see it through the sort of, what's it called? Like a
wire mesh glass.
You see it out. And a quick side note, that plaza, sculpture plaza, actually was designed for Henry Moore by the architect. But then he went over budget, so they never were able to pay for Henry Moore to finish his sculpture, which he has designed already. So, and then we continue going up into the nave, which is a new built space where the organ used to be. And so it's like a plaza, but usually you have a plaza around one sort of bell tower. Here we see 5 bell towers high up into this. How tall are they? 8 meters?
They vary, but they're between 8 and 8.5 meters, yeah.
It's almost like a busy square of people walking around them.
Yes. So when you asked me to do this show, I had a sense that some of the works that you'd seen and perhaps pre-imagined in the space had been this series of towers that I've been working on for quite a long time. And I mentioned before that Giotto experience of walking into a depicted historical town. And I guess I've worked on that through the idea of castles into seeing architecture, urban architecture, as being very much a kind of landscape, an environment that I could recreate using drawing as a tool. And what I found is that the best object to use for that is a tower. Towers are often useless. Okay, they might be for keeping an eye on the population from like a prison tower or a security tower looking out. The Romans often would build a tower so they could keep an eye on the population. But more often than not, they're only there to hold a bell that will sound louder and also just to impress.
Yeah.
The San Gimignano in Italy, where the story goes that the local gentry would build bigger and bigger towers because their friend had built quite a big tower, and then they thought, well, we can build a big one. And
you think it's a male thing? Maybe, no?
Maybe. Probably it was males who were doing that. And of course, they are referential in that sense, but they do stand up from the landscape. They provide an impressive, distant motif, like church spires do in a Dutch landscape by Theo van Doesburg. You have these flat, beautiful flat Dutch landscapes with one or two pointy towers
that we've
all seen in northern France or Belgium, populating and piercing the sky and the landscapes. But towers have a very human, I think, in that rather pathetic sense of wanting to build up from the ground that we're stuck on. You know, we're very short, really.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget just how short we are. We're only managed to get about 1.70 meters our eyes up off the ground. Whereas, you know, you can get a much better view of the world if you're up in an aeroplane. And then, then you see, okay, that's what the world really looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But down here, we're stuck down here. But the tower is like this symbol of trying to sort of escape gravity, trying to move up from the ground. And I think humans have not pretty much always started civilization and cities. I was looking at some imaginary drawings of what they think Sumerian towns might have looked at. These were some of the first towns in the world about sort of 8,000 years ago. And it's extraordinary how sophisticated these towns looked. You know, we think of mud huts, but no, these are like huge ziggurat buildings that would impress you now, that would look like Washington, D.C. And a lot of these were centered on this sky-piercing towers. And you know, you think of the pyramids also doing the same thing. So a tower is like a kind of compressed version of architecture. It's got all the elements of architecture in it, but it's compressed to a point where it's no longer particularly useful. You can't really live in a tower.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be going up and down stairs all the time into one small room after another. Although Chris Burden designed a building that did just that, which was really cool. But anyway, so I found myself drawing towers and noticing them around the world. If you come across a really cool tower, there's usually some people at the bottom photographing it. Why are they photographing it? Because it has this standout quality within a town. It has this kind of
landmark.
It's a landmark, and it's also it's elegiac, I think. It's kind of rising in that sense. So what I tended to do was to go around countries, hiring a car and photographing the towers around the world. And I've done a few countries like that. But during COVID, I was stuck in London in my studio, and I found myself very, very slowly jogging around the neighborhood just to get out of the studio, really, and began to gather the towers that were around the studio. And I worked down near the City of London, which was burnt down in the 17th century and rebuilt largely by an architect called Christopher Wren, who's famous for building St. Paul's Cathedral. And he and his followers got the job to build all the new churches that had been burned down. And they ended up with a skyline
mm-hmm.
of these towers, which are all from pretty much the same period and style. So I've drawn five of them, and they are fairly close to reality.
Mm-hmm.
I took some liberties in terms of drawing them because they need to stand up as a flat drawing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't have a floating window in the middle of the drawing.
Sure.
It needs mm-hmm. to be joined
to something
or
somewhere.
It will fall down. So these provide me with these sort of, you talked before about these little markers for games that you move around, the Ludo it's called in English. I don't know, you have a similar game, I think, where you get...
Mensch, ärgere dich nicht.
You roll a dice, you go around a board,
exactly.
And if you land on someone else, they're out.
Kick him out, exactly, yeah.
So you have these like these little markers.
Yeah.
I was thinking more where I am from a post-war generation, and we used to play with little soldiers, and they all had to have a little base.
Yeah.
And then they were pretty, you know, they were like little statues of soldiers.
So yeah.
These buildings have that kind of quality. They have a base.
Yeah.
And then they stick up as a flat drawing from that base. But in order to stick up 8 meters, I need a material that will allow that. And I looked in the world for some kind of language that could make sense of that. And I came across the language of basically gates. So gates are a method of creating a barrier, but mm-hmm. not a visual barrier.
Yeah.
And we see them everywhere.
Yeah.
And so I started photographing and drawing and thinking about metalwork, gates, and gathering that information. Often these gates are architectural in style themselves. They might be brutalist, like your gates here,
yeah.
or they might be Baroque, or they might be classical in mm-hmm. style, often reflecting the architecture of the town
time.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can imagine, we're back in the kitchen with your cooking lesson, that you're chucking in some gates and you're chucking in some Baroque towers
and
you're
them.
Chucking in mm-hmm. The little soldiers with their bases, this might be what you'd end up with.
Yeah, and there are five of them.
There are five, largely because I think five is a very good number for not having symmetry.
Yeah.
If you've got four, it's really hard to place things without it ending up looking very much like a box.
Yeah, yeah.
Three is quite good. I often use three because it's an odd number and stuff, but it's still the triangulation tends to lock the works in. Once you get up to five, there's a sense of like whatever.
And the five are from your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then the people walking around, so we see LED screens, which is interesting because there you see the people from the side. You never face them, right?
Yes. And this is something that I found to be a very powerful tool, is the difference between the figure seen from the side and the figure seen from front on.
Yeah.
You and I were talking across the table front on, and that's quite confrontational.
Yeah.
You know, I sense your presence very
strongly. We have a little bit...
you're hidden, okay.
But, microphone in the middle, yeah.
But I think we sense each other's presence quite strongly. But yeah. Danai here, who's from the side, you know, it's a much calmer relationship,
yeah.
Right? And maybe to do with Danai. But when you see people on the street, I've noticed this when I was collecting my kids from school, and it's raining, as it always is in London. I'm in the car with the windscreen wipers on. And I see in front of me this this amazing ballet of people crisscrossing on the street, walking past. And I think this is like an amazing palette of possible elements within a constantly changing picture. But I don't have any relationship with those people. I don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. They don't know who I am. And within 3 seconds, they're gone. So this sideways view has a very different quality. It's much easier to look at people when they're passing you by than it is to look at them straight on, because then you're in danger. If you look at someone straight on, you know, the look, the gaze is confrontational. They might not like you. You might have to deal with them, da, da, da. This sideways
They're in their own world, right?
They're in their own world, yeah. And they have their own... What I found is that when you draw them like that, they're very dignified.
Mm-hmm.
They're very universal. They feel like a universal human. With great dignity as they walk past you. And I find that a very useful quality in terms of drawing, very different from when the person is facing you.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously with a moving figure, if they were walking straight towards you, this would be very difficult because they'd get bigger as they got closer to you, which I can't really draw, because then what do? They've got really big and then you're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas walking sideways past you, they can walk forever. And I deal with that in two ways. One is a static walk, where the person is walking as if they were on a treadmill. So their feet are sliding like Michael Jackson on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is to allow them to actually move. But for that, I need a very long screen, because they move down the screen and then they move back. I recently did a project in Amsterdam along the canals where I had a very long screen, 20 meters long. And the people walked from one end of the screen to the other. And when they got to the other end, they then in imaginary art world, they moved around back to the beginning and came across again. Mm-hmm. So we had this kind of constant stream of people crisscrossing. But here in the gallery, I didn't want that. I didn't want to kind of cover the sides of the walls with long screens for various reasons, including the fact that that would give you some very large screens to have to deal with. But I had this idea more of like six individuals, and that their movement would give you the sense of a kind of crowd of people moving in amongst these buildings. So bearing in mind what I said at the beginning about an exhibition being twofold, it's both an exhibition of works that I've been making recently, which I'd like to show, and that we'd like to put out into the world in collectors' houses and museums and so on. But it's also an experience for the people coming into the exhibition, which they will only see as a unified thing. And that allows certain opportunities to create a kind of world that people can walk into, which includes the chapel, which includes the nave, includes the brutalist architecture, and includes all of the works together and the world that they create in that space. So the six people walking are individual works, each one, and the five towers are all individual works. But when they're all put together, it creates what I hope is a sort of engaging environment that you can be in the same way that you might be in a computer game or in my virtual reality exhibition.
Yeah, because you, as a spectator, walk around the people and the towers.
Yes, naturally, I think people are drawn, I hope, from the small entrance to the side of the gallery into this giant space, which is, you know, it's a moment. As you come through that small door, the space opens up enormously.
Yeah.
And I've tried to echo and engage with that and use the energy of that moment. I've also tried to reference the fact that it's a church, and it looks like a church. And I often do that with an exhibition because most gallery and museum spaces, if you think about what they look like mostly, they don't look like your bedroom.
Mm.
They probably look more like a church or a temple or a meeting room or a...
As minimal as they can somehow.
Something like that. And I often tend to use the answers that have been developed over thousands of years for those kinds of spaces, which would include how churches are dealt with. You know, often in a church, the most extraordinary moment is the long distance view down on the altar. And then the altar is this explosive golden moment of imagery and sculpture. And then down the sides, you have a slightly quieter series of moments where you look in the chapels.
Yeah.
And you see maybe some statues and so on.
But here you did it upside down.
Like, it is upside down.
The reserve,
slightly.
Right? Yeah.
What I found was if I put a giant altar-like image behind the five towers, it interrupted that understanding and vision of the five towers. And it undermined them instead of adding to them. You're kind of like trying to see the painting, the altar painting through them, because they act like columns down the main space. So I've actually put the giant imagery, which I hesitate to say altar because it's not religious. I'm not referring to that in that sense. I'm referring to it architecturally. But it's actually behind you at the other end of the nave.
Yeah.
So once you've experienced the five towers, moved into the space, if you turn around, you'll see probably the biggest painting I've made so far, which is something like 4 by 4.5 meters,
yeah,
which we had to make in the space because it wouldn't fit up through the hole in the floor. And so that acts as a kind of finishing end point to the exhibition. And this depicts people walking also, like the smaller films, but a different group, a different body of work, which I made specifically for this exhibition. And when I realized that I needed this work, I set out on my bike up to the nearest, busiest shopping street in London, which is an area called Islington. Specifically, it's called the Angel Islington. I'm not quite sure why, I should find out. But it's, so I've titled this series The Angel, because I kind of like the title rather more than Islington or Upper Street.
Yeah.
It's called the Angel Islington. There's a tube station there, underground station called the Angel. And I stood on a traffic island. I like traffic islands a lot. They strike me as being a kind of last point of loneliness in a city. No one stands on a traffic island.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to. You get some suspicious looks if you do, but there's a kind of quiet.
Yeah.
And the trees, the palm trees, become the traffic lights and the lampposts. And around you is the sea full of sharks, which are the cars.
Yeah.
And so I quite like standing out there. So I stood out there with my iPhone and I photographed the people walking along the pavement and came up with a series of, I think, maybe 20 or 30 drawings of people who happened to be walking there that day.
Because what I like about the painting is it's an ongoing flow.
Yes.
Right, you can imagine like 5 seconds later, it's a different group of people.
Different, and I've done like 10 or more paintings using the four people that are necessary in that format. And they could be grouped in various different ways.
Does your work actually know weather?
Yes, I've done versions of this in the rain with
because
umbrellas.
Because they wear coats, right, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, it's very... When I first started this series of drawing people walking, I started to do it in different parts of the world. So I did it in Boston, New York, Mumbai, Tokyo, Seoul, wherever I happened to be working, really. And I found that the people in these different places had very, you know, if you draw a bunch of people in Mumbai, you get incredible saris, you get flip-flops. Everybody's got black hair, which is a very different thing to draw. You go to Melbourne and it's like everybody's got tattoos and they've got sandals and shorts. You know, everybody had a different kind of mood.
Yeah.
But then I started to find, for one thing, filming is very complicated. It's difficult to set up. It's easier to do from my studio. But I also thought if I stick to around London, I can deal different times of the year because I can revisit the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that doing a painting that was of people in the winter has a completely different feel from the summer because everybody's body is completely covered. They've all got hats on, big puffy coats.
Yeah.
And the composition becomes very full. And I thought, maybe it's geeky, but for me, that's kind of interesting that you end up with a different composition because it's a different time of year. And then this different composition around allows for different kinds of drawings. If everybody's got a big heavy coat on, you don't need to draw the careful lines of a thigh or a foot. You're just drawing a big puffer coat.
Yeah.
So you can do a much more pared down, simplified drawing. And that allows for different types of materials. You can use steel and concrete much more easily if you've got these very simple structural lines than if you've got more complicated bendy ones, which you need for the summer drawings. So I suppose what I tend to do is, like you're going back to cooking, is I go to the market and I buy what's on offer. And in the summer, this is what's on offer: shorts, sandals, arms. And then I see what I can make with that and what would go well with that. So here we've got early summer, I'd say.
So you juxtapose the figures. It's not one still of a whole group.
This series that you've got is quite a formalized group of paintings.
Mm-hmm.
The people are equidistant to each other. They're placed as if they're in an ancient frieze. Sort of, they're composed. They're clearly composed. The gap between each one is the same. There is another way of doing it, which is to mix it up a bit.
Yeah.
So that it's much more casual, and then it has a different feeling. It's more dynamic,
but they're cut,
less classical.
To the left and to the right.
Half of going one way, half of going the other. That's not an absolute rule. Sometimes I'll do three and one, but generally there's a feeling of crisscrossing.
Yeah. No, but that's, I think it's the dynamic where you think it goes on and on.
Yeah.
You know, like an endless float. And then when you leave the nave through the sculpture garden, or actually a very important detail when you're downstairs in what I call the An Ancestor Gallery, when you look out to the sculpture garden, you see lying figures. Maybe you can explore on them too.
Well, when I came here a year ago and you and I looked around the gallery at the various spaces, I was struck by how this secret garden surrounds the brutalist church. It has a very different mood from the church, but obviously it's very affected by it. And you feel like you're lost in there. And I thought this would be a great moment to show a work with a rather different mood. And a couple of years ago, I came up with this group of work that was inspired in a way by the scenes that we all saw during COVID, where everybody wanted to get out from the house, but they couldn't meet anywhere. They weren't allowed to. So people would head for the parks. And during a couple of summers, all the London parks were just full of people. And I would wander around photographing the groups of people in the park, because they seemed to physically and bodily create very interesting dynamic groups.
Mm-hmm.
One person would be sitting in a yoga-ish kind of position looking at their phone. Another one would be collapsed out on the ground taking in the sun. Someone else reading their book. And each body would be very tellingly placed in a way that I hadn't really dealt with in the past. And the reason I hadn't dealt with it is because it's very three-dimensional. It's not like a flat drawing anymore, because I don't have drawings of these people at all. I didn't ever bother to do it because I can't. How do you draw someone who's sitting cross-legged? You know, you just can't.
Yeah.
Because their legs are twisted in amongst each other.
Yeah.
You have to approach the drawing in another way. And what we did was we made 3D models of those people so that I could spin them around.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do this quite easily on your phone. You can take photographs from all the way around someone and build a 3D model. And then I tried to sort of place imaginary sticks into that body shape to create three-dimensional drawing that was quite complex. And in order to, having done that, I then looked for a material language that seemed sensible and familiar and fitted the technology of that shape.
Mm-hmm. It's stainless steel, no?
What I ended up using was, like, you know, on the street where you go to lock your bike.
Yeah.
You see these rows of stainless steel tubes.
Yeah.
You often see it at football stadiums, also for handrails or on ships. You get a lot of this stainless steel used by the sea, because you can bend stainless steel
quite
well.
You mean like these Bauhaus sort of, you know, like the metal, round metal structure, like Tornet?
I don't know them, but I'm sure that that's the case.
Yeah.
So I started collecting photographs and drawings of these elements, which we're very used to out on the street, and imagining that the person who made these bicycle lock elements was maybe, I don't know, say on drugs, or was an art student at night, and decided to use the same technology as these bike racks, but start to draw with it.
Yeah.
And to draw people instead, so that we could have a language, street language, to draw sort of the people who are out on the street in the parks, and bring all of that together to create a sort of stand-in in a way for humans, like a mental construct, and place that back out into the environment. So in your, what I found with these sculptures is the best place for them is on grass, because then you've got this kind of picnic group,
sunbathing,
déjeuner sur l'herbe kind of atmosphere out on the grass, but in, instead of actual people, there are these tubular, bright mirrored stainless steel figures. So I've put three of them, we talked about before, making a nice little group. Each person's in a completely different kind of position.
In their own world again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ancestor room.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time going to stately homes, because I like looking at the, I'm really in love with 17th and 18th century portrait painting, particularly English and French. And I love the kind of the way that they evoke the presence of people. If you think of Hogwarts in Harry Potter, you know, this idea of the presence of a generation or generations of people. This places art and paintings in a very different environment from what we think of as going to an art gallery and looking at paintings. The reason people had those paintings was it meant that they could have their ancestors present, so that they were often painted with a dark background. Then you have to think you're in a room with only candlelight at night. Then they're painted at life size. You'd have a room full of your ancestors, their images looming out from the wall in the candlelit room, as present as your friends and family at
the table. Yeah.
So painting and art then becomes a very different role and a very interesting role than we're used to it as something to admire and to look at the paint the brush strokes of. And I also like going into museums and where you see like historical museums and seeing all of the portraits in a room lined up around the walls in gold frames and imagining them as a crowded people at an opening, all sort of maybe talking to each other. So I just wanted to mention that when you talked about the room of ancestors, that paintings often have these different roles in society. And you look back in history, you look at the way that sculptures function in Indonesia in the 19th century, carved wooden, you know, they were protective figures in the longhouse made of wood, you know, but then you bring that into an art gallery, it tends to kind of dumb it down a bit. But seeing those things out in the jungle and in the highlands in Vietnam would be a very different experience. And I recently went to Easter Island to go and look at the heads there, because you know, they have this, they're incredible sculptures, but they've also got this incredible sense of place next to a volcano looking out across the Pacific.
So, but it's interesting how your portraits age well, because you did this portrait of Walter and it looks like as if you have done it last week.
That was fun to do, your uncle, Walter Koenig.
But that in 1980, right?
Asked me to make the first public sculpture I ever made, which I did in my garden back in London. And also in the process of that relationship, I ended up drawing him as a portrait.
Yeah, but then when was this, like 79 or 80?
I think the project itself with the books on the bookshop must have been 85.
Uh-huh.
And then the portrait came about a little later. Maybe, 6 or 7.
Yeah.
It was one of my favorites.
Because it's still...
He's got a very charming face and
presence. Exactly, and it's still up to date, you know. Great. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.